From Buck's studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Rob Ferret, sitting in for Tom Clark, and I'm here with family doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share down-to-earth advice, and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question, the number to call is 1-800-462-7413. And along with your calls, we have some topics to talk about, Zorba.
Coffee. Are some people more hardwired for coffee? That is a good question that I would like to answer for me. Interesting genetic stuff about the product that we love to drink in the morning. And then we're going to talk about all the hubbub about flossing, how it's not good for us and who says it's not good for us and should we really continue flossing? Nobody is really against brushing their teeth, but flossing is always an arduous project to do in the evening or in the morning whenever you floss.
And our recipe today.
Seaweed salad. Now, for those of you who have not tried seaweed, those are a lot of you probably haven't even tried kale, but if you haven't tried seaweed, we're talking about seaweed salad, which is exactly the opposite of iceberg lettuce, but it's a wonderful salad that you may want to experiment with. Be adventurous and find out what this recipe is all about.
Well, let's also be adventurous and go to the phones. To the phones we go at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Our first caller joins us from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help you out today?
Well, about 7 or 8 years ago, in my late 50s, I developed AFib or atrial fibrillation. And initially, the doctor put me on, well, they tried to do a cardioversion several times, and it just never worked. And so I ended up, because my overall health was still pretty good, I just was taking an aspirin a day and some blood pressure medication. But when I turned 65, the doctor put me on, took me off the aspirin and put me on Eliquis initially. And after a few months, I developed a rash. And at first, I couldn't figure out what it was. I went with that for several months before I finally went to a dermatologist, and they did a biopsy of just a small section of skin. And it turned out that the rash was a result of a reaction to a drug. And so I assumed it was from the Eliquis. And I contacted the doctor. He changed it to Pradaxa. And at first I thought, well, this is going to take care of it. But the rash has continued. It's not intolerable, especially when I get warm. My skin's hot. It really kind of flares up, and there's a lot of itching to it. But I've got a cream that kind of takes care of that. My main concern is there something in addition that I should be concerned about as far as the rash is concerned? I've heard some rumors about some of these newer blood thinner medications and if there's an additional problem besides the rash.
So the first thing I would question is when you look at the theory and you look at the data and they don't agree, then you have to question either the theory is wrong or the data is wrong. So they did a biopsy, and they said that this is probably a drug reaction. You can't really tell from the skin absolutely that it's a drug reaction at all. So the first thing I would question, since you stopped the Eliquis, which is one of the blood thinners, the rash didn't go away, whether or not the rash was from the Eliquis at all. May not have been that way. I mean, dermatology is not an on-off absolute diagnostic for something such as a drug reaction. For something such as psoriasis, yes, you can tell. Dermatologists can easily look at it. If they have a question, they biopsy it. So I don't know what your rash is from, but I doubt very much if the rash is from the Eliquis or Pradaxa. But I want to go back for just a second. AFib, not an uncommon problem when you got to be over 65. They looked at a scoring system. It's a scoring system called the CHADS 2 score, and it's a way of scoring the risk for a stroke because atrial fib puts you at risk. So your doctor did the right thing. Warfarin was initially the drug of choice for many, many years. They're newer blood thinners that do not require as much monitoring. So I don't know what your rash is from. That's kind of the issue, and I would question whether it's the Eliquis or Pradaxa. I rather doubt it's from that. That's the issue. What are you doing for the rash?
Well, I got a formulary where they it's a mixture of, it's not a over-the-counter.
Where is the rash? Where is it?
It's on my upper chest and even across my back, along the top of my shoulders, maybe just to the base of my neck. Mm-hmm. And like I say, it's not In fact, like right now, I don't feel it at all.
I would get a second opinion from another dermatologist. That's what I would do. I would get the slides for the other dermatologist, you know, and have the dermatologist look at the slides. They read slides or read the diagnosis, and that's what I would do. I would question the diagnosis because I think the diagnosis is in question. Okay.
Could it be, I'm on a couple of other, like I take Lipitor for...
It could be other medications,
but it could
have nothing to do with the medications at all.
That's
the real issue. It could be the combo or nothing to do with it. I would get a second opinion on what the rash is from, because quite often, if one dermatologist cannot figure it out, the other dermatologist can. So good luck.
Good luck sorting that out.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for the call. And that's a thing it seems like we run across often, Zorba. This thing happened soon after. Maybe you started that medication. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's the medication. Maybe it's something completely different.
Well,
and that
actually is the whole thing when it comes to science. You start something, and then there may be something that's coincidental, and then we immediately ascribe a cause and effect that it's not coincidental, and that's a question that kind of comes up. But this is a good thing where you have to get a second opinion, because this gentleman has to stay on the medication because that's important for his health. He's got a rash.
That's a
trade-off. You got it.
If you have a question for Dr. Zorba, give us a call, 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Before we go back to our callers, though, Zorba, a topic today, one that's close to my heart, coffee.
Coffee, close to my heart and close to my gullet, because I drink coffee every morning.
You drink a fair amount of coffee.
I love coffee. I get up in the morning. I love coffee. In fact, this morning when I got up, I turn on. I've got a coffee, you know, coffee that's on a timer, and I turned it on so the coffee would go on. And I walked downstairs and I said, "Oh my God, I don't have my fresh coffee. What am I going to do?" So I took the dog out anyway, you know, and woke up. But this is a very interesting thing, because the question is, within Europe, there are great differences. The Italians drink a certain amount of coffee. The Dutch drink more coffee than the Italians. Are there genes that allow the caffeine to express itself? Now, let's remember, the Dutch introduced coffee into New England when they came in the 1600s. That was the drink of choice that they had. What do you think, Rob, the New Englanders drank in the morning before the Dutch introduced coffee? Now, you've got 10 seconds.
Part of me wants to guess tea, but I know what the habits were like back then. Some form of alcohol? Rum?
It was rum. They would get up and have a glass of rum in the morning. Now, let's think about it. The Dutch came in and had coffee. The New Englanders had rum. Who was more efficient at their daily tasks? Obviously, coffee.
The New Englanders didn't notice who was more efficient
So there is a gene, the PDSS2 gene, which seems to be how quickly the body breaks down caffeine. It's one of several genes, so we don't know specifically. But this gene breaks down coffee, and lo and behold, the Dutch, who drink more coffee than the Italians, because the Italians drink about 2 to 3 cups a day. The Dutch drink nearly 6 cups of coffee a day. The Dutch are more likely to have the PDSS2 gene of breaking down caffeine, which means the Dutch, they drink the coffee, the caffeine gets broken down by the gene. They drink the coffee, the caffeine gets broken down by the gene. So they have to drink more of it. Whereas the Italians don't have the gene. They can have 1 or 2 cups and be alive and awake for the entire day.
Okay, so the caffeine has more of an effect, a faster effect on
the
Italians. Maybe if I don't have that gene.
Than the Dutch. That's exactly right. So the Dutch have to drink more and more coffee with their gene. So the real question is for us, for Americans, if we've got some Dutch heritage or Italian heritage, what about the German heritage? What about the Eastern European heritage? You know, I mean, but it shows you why some people can get by and crave more coffee than others. It may be from their gene.
Well, and some people, you know, one cup of coffee and they're, you know, bouncing
right,
through the roof.
Right, they're wired. Maybe their genes. What did you assume?
Well, I figured it's how much coffee you drink. That might still be part of the story. Genes aren't everything here. If you have never had caffeine before, maybe that first cup is going to have a profound impact on you.
Well, you've got to be careful. You could become addicted. I mean, you know, coffee.
It's habit.
Cigarettes. I mean, really, it's a habit forming drink. But remember, it's good for you. It does not cause cancer. If you're not a Puritan, you drink as much coffee as you want.
You know what? It doesn't hurt me if I don't drink coffee. It's very bad for the people around me. if I haven't had enough coffee. You know, my morning coffee, my mid-morning coffee, my afternoon coffee.
The whole thing.
I'm less pleasant to be around. But Zorba and I are pleasant to be around, and you can call in and talk to us at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Back to our callers now, Zorba. We're going to Mesa Mani, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. How are you guys?
Good. How are you doing today?
Good. I haven't had my cup of coffee yet today, so I've got to jump on that.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Well, we'll put up with you anyway. What can we help you with?
Yeah, thank you. A couple of years ago, I noticed a scab develop inside my nose, and at the time, I didn't really think much of it. I only really started to realize it might be an issue after a year had gone by, and now, like I said, this was about 2 years ago that the scab seems like it first developed. And it just tends to be just inside one of my nostrils, and it'll kind of accumulate mucus on a regular basis, probably a couple times a day. And whenever I blow my nose, there's just a lot of buildup around the scab, and oftentimes I'll go to kind of clear the area out, and the site won't bleed, but it will kind of be sore. There will be a little bit of pain. And then it'll be clear for a while, and then it'll build back up. And I've always expected the scabbing to go away at some point, you know, for the tissue to maybe scar up. I saw somebody for allergies last year, and they looked at it, and they said, oh, well, you know, try some over-the-counter creams and lotions, try Aquaphor, try anything that's going to help the skin heal. And so I tried a few things, and it didn't really seem to help. Long term, it helped for a little bit, but I guess my big question is this something that's just a thing on its own because it really is bearable, or is it a sign of something else going on? Maybe
before Zorba tackles this, I get a little bit of this myself sometimes. And since we're taking a deep dive into the geography of your nose, let's locate this a little bit. He says it's
one nostril, the nose,
and the middle part, like on the septum. And I'm pointing at it. Yep. That doesn't help you, or is it kind of on the outside?
Yeah, it's on the septum. I would say it's in the back, toward the back of the nose. It's on my right side, so my right nostril, the back side of the septum.
This is almost TMI.
I need it. I think it's exactly the right amount of information.
So
I can picture this.
So the real issue is whether or not you've got a chronic little infection there. A lot of people, a number of people are staph carriers. They actually have staph in their nose. Doesn't bother them. It doesn't produce an issue. You might have staph in the nose. You might have something called MRSA, which is methicillin-resistant staph. I've got a couple of very specific recommendations. There's a cream. It's in a cream form and an ointment, and it's called Bactobam by prescription, B-A-C-T-O-B-A-M. Bactobam, it is a generic, either the ointment or the cream. And what I would do is I would put it in twice a day for about a month. See if you can get rid of it. I wouldn't stay with it. You know, if you've got something in your nose that is chronically infected, you want to get it cured. And basically, this ointment and this cream usually does it. You may want to get a culture prior to that. We culture noses before people end up having implant surgeries, such as knee replacement surgery and hip replacement surgery, to see whether or not they actually have staph infections in their nose, because it's chronic, often asymptomatic, but you may be one of the people who have it. And it doesn't really hurt them, but it's kind of there. So you need a diagnosis. You need the cream. And your doctor may say, let's just put you on the cream initially, or they may say you ought to get a culture before that. But, yeah, you can get rid of this thing. I wouldn't live with it. I would get rid
Super.
Of it. Okay?
So this has been pretty annoying. You said it's not debilitating, but pretty annoying.
Yeah, it just ends up being that thing in the day where you get up and you're like, oh, why does my nose feel clogged? Oh, that's right. There's a bunch of gunk in
there. Yeah, that's right.
And
exactly.
You've got to get it out.
And you're out in public. This is one place where you just can't scratch.
No,
you don't want to scratch that itch in public.
Can't.
Well, there's more than one place that you just can't scratch.
That's true.
It's only
there
one
are multiple places.
Of the places that you cannot scratch. That's right.
Well, good luck getting to the bottom of this. I hope that ends up helping you out.
Thank you so much.
You know, you bring up an interesting point. There's certain places that you're allowed to scratch in public.
Right. I'm scratching my head.
Then there are other places which you are not allowed to scratch in public. Now, is that because of our puritanical heritage, or is it, I mean, or was this a sort of society issue that goes way back? Do you think cavemen and cavewomen really cared where they scratched? I mean, let's think about that.
I suspect they scratched anywhere. I think we need a grant for a cross-cultural survey.
Evaluation.
Where we go to each country of our choosing.
Absolutely.
Spend
I'm going to get the airfare.
2-3 months.
We're going to start it. We're going to start in the stands. Then from the stands, we're going to go to Bali, see where you can
scratch. I want to get to the Mediterranean.
Bali, we'll get to the Mediterranean Sea. We will do a cross-cultural scan evaluation. And my guess is someone has gotten a PhD somewhere at some time in the scratch analysis that's cross-cultural. We just have to find it. And we have the web, so we can find out for sure.
To scratch or not to scratch.
That is the question.
Before we take a quick break, Zorba, it is time for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc.
Disagreeing with the Doc. Disagreeing with the Doc. Oh, oh, oh.
The following email came to us from a listener named Susan from Los Ranchos, New Mexico. She writes, "Hi, Zorba. I was listening to the podcast..." Not on the radio. Very modern.
What's a podcast?
The podcast. We'll have to ask the youth. I was listening to the podcast today.
I'll ask my grandchild, who's a year and a half. She probably knows what a podcast is.
Oh, podcast. Almost. Those are passe.
She knows how to swipe. She knows how to swipe.
All right. Now you're not talking stealing.
No. Okay. That's right.
Larceny.
Definition number
Zorba
two
family.
in there. So please, go on.
I'll go on with Susan's email. So Susan, to keep us up to date here, she was listening to the podcast while running and heard the very young woman who called about knee pain while beginning to train for a 5K. You advised her to get busy with quad strengthening, which is great advice for someone who's not been walking or running much for a period of many months. But I would add to that advice this. Please, 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 three pleases, go get fitted for good fitting running shoes. Nothing is more fundamental to a successful running or walking program than a pair of shoes that fit your feet. She writes, shoes do not have to be expensive, but they have to fit properly and be correctly constructed for your foot strike. I speak as someone who began seriously running several years ago. I've run many races, including completing 5 half marathons, and cannot speak highly enough of my many pairs of wonderful shoes.
Absolutely good point.
Not so much disagreeing. Yeah.
No, perfectly good point. It's very important to look at your shoes. And shoes wear out when it comes to running. It may not wear out when you're getting up and going to work and walking, but the cushioning within the shoes wears out. And if you have any athletic sport, it's really important to be fit properly and wear the right shoe. She brings up a really good point. The shoe does not have to be expensive. The shoe has to fit right. Mm-hmm. You know, because when we look at athletic shoes, part of it is the shoe itself on how well it's constructed. And the other part is fashion. And I periodically read the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. I like to peruse things. And believe it or not, I peruse the fashion section of both the Times.
And it shows in your clothing choices.
And the Wall Street Journal. It shows. I'm a fashion hound. I'm my own fashion.
Dedicated follower of fashion.
Yes, my fashion. But I do not buy the $1,000 sweaters and the $500 shoes. But in the fashion section, you can find shoes there, athletic shoes, that cost $550.
That's a bit much for my taste.
That's exactly it. But a $50 pair of shoe may fit as well. So go for the fitting, not for the style.
Now, in my youth, and this was before podcasts, mind you, I wore a popular brand of youth shoe main feature of it was absolutely no arch support at all.
Oh.
I walked a lot, and this is going to amaze you, Zorba.
A Chucky's.
I didn't want to name names. I'm not naming
names.
You can
name names. I've got a Chucky. The Chucky has no support at all.
I walked in these shoes a lot, and you'll never guess. My feet hurt and my knees hurt all the time.
And actually, I wear my Chuckies to go out sometimes. I mean, when I dress up, I have 3 pairs of Chuckies. And I dress up and I used to wear them as a kid and I thought, there's no support in
nothing.
This. My foot hurts me at the end of the time. That's right.
The price we pay for fashion.
You know what? Chuckies is never going to sponsor this show. I know that. I know that for sure.
Well, not now. Have you heard Zorba put his foot in his mouth? Let's keep him on his toes. Carl made me say those. Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our recipe is coming up along with more of your calls and another interesting topic to discuss right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Rob Ferret here, sitting in for Tom Clark with Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our number again is 1-800-462-7413. If you have a question for the good doc, but before we get back to our callers, Zorba, tell us about our recipe this week, seaweed salad.
Seaweed salad. So, Rob, I have a question for you. Did your mother serve you seaweed as a child?
At no point in my child. I didn't eat seaweed until, about three decades in, I'm going to say.
So what was the salad of choice in your house?
We were big iceberg people. Oh, yeah, we had a lot of iceberg lettuce. I still like, there's still times where iceberg does hit the spot, though I do go for funkier, fancier greens from time to time. But seaweed, my only way of eating seaweed really is in, those sushi rolls,
right.
Which it took
right.
me a long right. time right. to acquire the taste. My wife.
Well, you didn't like the texture of it or what?
Didn't like the taste or the texture of seaweed, but now I love them. Mm-hmm. I love them.
Well, and that's exactly it. When it comes to eating, it comes to different food. Adventurous food means eating different textures. Different foods that you weren't necessarily brought up with. And if you look at American society, food is changing. Look at kale. Kale was basically something you put on the plate to make it look differently. You're laughing.
Because I know what's coming.
No, I'm not going to be on an anti-kale quest.
You've got the shirt.
I've got the Facebook page. We're going to post it on the Facebook page. It's a Facebook page photo. I've had so many hits on this. And it basically is the no kale t-shirt. And when I wear that, people stop me on the street and they say, what? I don't like kale either. It's very, very interesting. But kale has its place.
Right. I like making kale
and
chips.
And seaweed has its place.
Yeah. Now,
and iceberg lettuce, although it has zero nutritional value, it pretty much has its place in the pleasure palace of eating.
All right. Well, this is not iceberg salad. This is not kale salad. This is seaweed salad. And I don't have to go out to the ocean with a rake.
No, you
don't. And collect my own seaweed.
Don't.
You can buy this stuff in stores.
Seaweed salad. Okay. You start out with 1 ounce of dry mixed seaweed. And, of course, you have to get this at an Asian grocery store.
An ounce of dry mixed seaweed.
That's right. 1 tablespoonful of rice vinegar, plus you're going to use another teaspoon later on.
Right. 1 big tea rice vinegar plus another big tea, for later.
1 tablespoon of toasted sesame oil.
Big tea toasted sesame oil.
1 tablespoonful of soy sauce.
Big tea soy sauce. Sounds good. 1 tablespoonful
of sugar.
Big tea of sugar. Substitute anything.
Oh, you
for
can
this?
Substitute anything. You could use Splenda if you wanted to. You could use an artificial sweetener if you don't want sugar. You could use honey, but that will change the taste.
I'm just going to use some sugar.
1/2 teaspoon of salt.
1/2 little tea salt.
1/2 teaspoon of ginger juice.
1/2 little tea ginger juice.
Well, once again, you've got to get this in an Asian grocery store. It is an Asian-themed salad.
Okay, I like ginger. Don't get me wrong. I'm drinking ginger tea as we speak.
Now there's juice. That is true. You like ginger tea. 1 tablespoonful of toasted sesame seeds.
Big tea toasted sesame seeds.
And a chopped scallion.
A scallion, or a green onion, I call them.
That's right.
Finely chopped.
Put the dry seaweed in a large bowl. Fill it with water. If you like some seaweed crunchy, soak it for 5 minutes. If you like it more tender, soak it for 10 minutes, but you're going to rehydrate that seaweed. Then to make the dressing, combine the rice vinegar, sesame oil, soy sauce, sugar, salt, and ginger juice in a small bowl, whisk it together, then drain the seaweed that you have rehydrated, use it with your hand, squeeze out that excess water, wipe out any excess water in the bowl, and then return the seaweed to the bowl, put the dressing on, top it with the sesame seeds, toss it to combine, and voila, plate your salad, garnish it with the scallions, and you now have a mixed seaweed salad, something that's actually pretty easy to make up and is tasty.
This did come together really easily. I wonder, this sounds like it'll end up probably at room temperature. I wonder if I'd want to throw that in the fridge for half an hour,
serve
a little chili. That sounds good to me.
You might want to do that. You may want to serve it maybe with a nice noodle dish at your house. You might want to have maybe some Sapporo. You want to have a beer that might be Japanese themed. And then you want to have 4 people over because it will serve 4. So 2 people over at the house. Or in your case, you can eat this with your 13-year-old girls and see if they will try it. What do you think the chances are?
They might because they'll do veggie rolls.
They'll do veggie rolls, they would try this.
Not too much different.
And the reality is you want to introduce different foods earlier to your children so they can enjoy different foods later on as they grow.
Well, if people want to enjoy this recipe later on, Zorba, where could they find it?
I bet if they go to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, you can look at this recipe, other recipes, look at fun stuff that's Zorba Pastor on Your Health, or don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
So zorbapastor.org, and Zorba, back to the phones we go. go at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. We'll go now to Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. I'm Mr. Rob. I recently got my varicose veins in my legs, the issue of them bulging and creating problems, heaviness, addressed. It's a new thing. It's called Venaseal, where they put a glue, rather than the laser, they go up with the glue, and they glue the vein shut.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the knee down, it's basically, it's like cut. I think they called it ablation, where they cut and pull out the vein.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a series of little cuts here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And the vein got pulled out in between. My question for the doc is, there's a tube of glue up the vein in my right and left leg.
Mm-hmm.
What? The vein, I know the vein will eventually atrophy and disappear. What happens to the glue?
The glue will stay. It's a foreign body in your body, which stays there. And if the glue is used, if it's an FDA approved glue, which is what I assume it is, because it's in the body and we're doing it, it should be FDA approved. It'll just be inert. You know, it's just like anything. It's just like an artificial knee that we have. I've got an ankle that has screws in it. That's artificial. Stays in my body. It's inert. It doesn't react. When people have heart surgery, they have staples that are put in. They're inert. They stay in the body. The glue is the same way. There's certain inert materials that the body does not react to, and things like catgut and other things the body can react to, for instance, in sutures, in which case then a little scar tissue forms over it. So it's not going to move anywhere, not going to do anything. And did you do it? Is that what you did?
It's a new way of addressing varicose veins. I was the second one in the state to have it done.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So why are you having your varicose veins taken care of? Is it because of pain or discomfort, or because you don't like the way it looks?
More the first ones. I mean, it doesn't look good. Don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I can live with that. But the big problem was in my left leg this year, one of the veins, it's like swelled up.
Right. Can be very symptomatic.
Almost an inch in diameter.
Right. No, it can be very symptomatic. Your leg feels heavy. Is that what's your main symptom? Heavy or tired?
Since I've had this done, it feels like I took an extra pair of shoes off my feet.
Wow.
Right. Well, because basically the blood is sitting there in the vein, it can become very symptomatic. The treatment is to ablate the veins.
That's with
cut
the
them,
laser, right?
Pull
usually?
Them out. Well, it's with the laser. There are other treatments also. But basically the idea is to get rid of the veins that are close to the surface. The veins that are more in the body will take over the blood return to the body. But these veins, once the valves break in the veins, that's where the varicose veins start. Sounds like they're shutting the valves, doing something, and if the procedure works, this might become the treatment of choice.
So, I wanted to ask, this is a new treatment. What led you to do this one instead of the laser ablation or other options that were out there? Did this sound like a better option?
It did, for a multitude of reasons, not the least of which was expense. The doctor who did it, he's new to the technology. He's been a surgeon for a long time, and he said, this is something new. Essentially, if I'm willing to be the guinea pig, he would do it for an extremely reduced rate.
And you're feeling okay so far?
Yeah, somebody's got to be first, so I thought, And in my own head, I just weighed, it's cyanoacrylate. It's super glue they put in there.
Yeah, well, that's inert in the body. Cyanoacrylate is inert. Yeah, so it's inert. We use it, and it's used in other parts of the body, too, so it's not going to go anywhere.
And how long has that glue been in there?
About 7-8 days ago.
Oh, wow. Good. So you're still recovering, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. I got there's, 9, 10 in my right leg and 14 little cuts in my left leg. And I have to wear the support things, not for the glue, but more for the cuts. I had this done on a Friday and went back to work on Monday.
Sounds great.
Well, you are advancing the cause of science. Good luck as you continue to recover.
Well, I appreciate the doc's opinion. I love listening to him, and I value his opinion. So thank you very much for your time, Doc.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All right. Well, thanks for that call. Do you have a question for Zorba? Call in at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. We'll go now to Vanita, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi. How are you all?
Good. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you. My husband is suffering from benign tremors, and it's hereditary in his family, but he sort of got like a double whammy. He shakes on the inside, both his legs, his arms, and now it's moved up to his face. they're treating me with a blood pressure pill, and I can't pronounce it, but it's N-A-D-O-L-I, and it's 40 milligrams, and that seems to help him, but we're getting worse. We're not getting better.
And this is something that other people in his family have experienced, you said?
Yes. They usually have the shaking of the head or the shaking of the hands, but right. He has it all over, and he shakes on the inside.
Yeah, no, the tremors. So he's on Naldolone? Is that what he's on? That's a beta blocker?
Yes.
Yeah, he's on Naldolone.
Yes.
Yeah, it's one of the beta blockers. Benign essential tremor is sort of an interesting misnomer for people. It's not Parkinson tremor. First of all, it's not benign in that it bothers you. It means benign. I don't know how it probably got named because it's not associated with another disease.
Right.
And essential is really a misnomer, although it's the same tremor that we have when we're anxious. If you're anxious and your voice begins to crack or tremble, it's the same amplitude, or rather frequency, of the tremor that we normally get, the tremor when we hold up our hands, that some people have more than another. Beta blockers are what we have. There are other treatments. Sometimes you can have a treatment with benzodiazepines, tranquilizers, things like Valium, Lorazepam, Lorazepam, and other medications that are in that can actually help reduce tremor. I think they reduce probably the anxiety associated with tremor. Has he ever been on any of those at all? Lorazepam?
No.
That would be another thing that I would consider for him. There's a long-acting alprazolam that may work for him. He may not want to take it because the side effects of the drug itself, because it actually is a tranquilizer, but the drug itself may help him with a tremor. And he may decide to get over those side effects, which can be sleepiness. Some people adjust to the side effects of the medication, and they go, I'd rather have the side effects of the medication if there's a tremor reduction. So I would consider long-acting alprazolam, 1 milligram tablet. It's sort of a high dose, but it sounds like he has a bad tremor. And I would see whether or not that would work, or maybe try the short-acting one, at least initially, and see if that would work. The other issue, has the beta blocker been taken to the highest amount, and has he tried other beta blockers?
Oh. Well, he just got on Medicare, and they weren't going to pay for this medication.
Mm-hmm.
So they put him on another one, and it was almost like he was having a seizure. He was shaking so bad. And he said, I can't do this. I'll pay the high price. I've got to get back on the medication I was on.
Okay, because the Naldolone, there's some beta blockers. They're very different. They're not all the same, and some will work better than another. There are other drugs that are beta blockers that are like Naldolone, and you may want to talk to your doctor about trying those to see if they're stronger, or pushing the Naldolone up to the highest tolerable dose. In other words, see if he can tolerate a higher dose of that. But I know this can be very bothersome. Does he have trouble feeding himself and drinking coffee?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We have weighted silverware and weighted dishes and everything.
Right, because that's the real issue is feeding yourself and drinking. It can be very, very problematic. So, well, good luck. I would try that, and I would consider long-acting alprazolam. Okay?
Okay. I appreciate your help. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for your call. Now, before the break, Zorba, let's hammer out another round of rapid fire.
Rapid fire. I am ready.
So rapid fire, Zorba quickly tackles listener questions from our inbox and our Facebook page. You say you're ready.
I am ready. I'm ready. I'm standing. I'm at the starting line. I've got my Olympic shoes on, and I am ready to sprint. Hit me.
First up, a listener named Amanda writes, hello, doctor. Do you have any tips for resolving UTI, urinary tract infection?
Excellent.
Without using antibiotics, she writes. So far, I've tried cranberry and D-mannose. I don't know, D-mannose. Uh-huh. It just sounds like a supplement.
Uh-huh. Cranberry juice, pushing fluids, antibiotics if you're symptomatic. I don't have other ways of doing it. You know, hygiene always plays a role in UTIs. And the other issue is if you're having sex, change of position with your sex can reduce the amount of UTIs, especially in young women. Those would be my suggestions.
But chronic UTI,
very tough.
Look
push
for the
fluids,
antibiotics.
Lots
then,
of
maybe?
Cranberry juice. Antibiotics are really the way to go if you continue to have them. But it's an issue with some women.
Thanks, Amanda. The next email is from Tim, who asks, is there any proof that anti-inflammatory diets do anything beneficial?
Well, some people say they do. Some people say they don't. Try it out and see if it works for your arthritis. That's what people usually use it for. And some people say, I feel better.
Worth a shot. Here's another email question. This one from a listener named Roger. Roger says, hi, Doc. My toenails are ugly, thick, opaque, discolored, misshapen, and difficult to cut. If it's a fungus, yeah, no fun. If it's a fungus, he says, what is the best remedy for this?
Well, Lamisil. Lamisil is a medication. It works well. It is now a generic. You take it for 12 weeks, 80% chance of success. If it fails, you take it for another 12 weeks, 80% chance it'll succeed in the failure rate. Lamisil, the real issue is cutting the nails. If they just look ugly, live with them. But if you can't cut your nails, then take the treatment.
And finally, Joe from West Bend, Wisconsin, asked the following question via Facebook. Is drinking from the hose dangerous? My husband does it when he works outside. I say it's not safe, even if he runs the hose till it's cold. I promised him I'd give him your answer.
I have to tell you, I drink from the hose, too, when I'm watering the garden. Every time I drink from the hose, I wonder, is this safe? And you know what the answer is? I don't know.
Well, I do know that if it's a fire hose, don't try to drink right out of that. If you have a question for Dr. Zorba, just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook and we will answer it.
We'll see it there. More calls to come, as well as another interesting topic and quacking up with Dr. Zorba. This is a fun one, by the way. All coming up on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Rob Ferret here, sitting in for Tom Clark with Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Zorba, before we take another caller, we've got another topic to share.
Yes, flossing. So if you
floss?
Well, how to floss? When to floss? Do you floss? It's very interesting because the Department of Agriculture, Health and Human Services dropped the mention of flossing when they came out with a report of what Americans should do to stay healthy, and it's caused a huge stir among people. You know, some people say, "Great, I don't have to floss. I really don't like flossing. I like brushing my teeth." And then the periodontists say, "Wait a minute, just because you dropped it doesn't mean that's actually true." And I think, you know, that we really think you really do have to floss. And a lot of people are left up in the air of what to do.
Right. And there was a big hullabaloo about this. And part of the story seems to be, yes, all the dentists think it's good to floss. We all assume it. But the research hasn't quite nailed it down
well,
for us.
Well, first of all, we have to look at some of the research. So some of the research is, in order to see the benefit of flossing, you have to look not just at cavities, you have to look at periodontal disease. Now, cavities are an issue. We know fluoride works. We know that drinking fluoride when you're younger makes a huge difference, incorporating that into your teeth. We know that fluoride toothpaste works. There's no doubt about it. And we know that too much sugar in your around your teeth, especially when you go at bedtime, is bad for your teeth. So now the question is cleaning. That's really what flossing is doing. It's cleaning the inside. The periodontists, the dentists say, the evidence isn't there because we haven't followed people for 5 to 10 years. And they're right. In other words, we don't have any credible evidence for long-term flossing. It's that the initial evidence, according to the Cochrane Review, which is an evaluation, is that a lot of it is not there.
And as I understand it, another problem is that a lot of people say, yes, I floss daily or almost daily, but they don't floss very well, and that's going to throw off some
of
the research.
Well, that is part of the issue. There's the right way to floss and the wrong way. Now, I've got a periodontist that I've gone to for 20 years, and he said, show me how you floss, and I showed him how I was flossing. He said, wait a minute, you're not doing that exactly right. You should do it this way. And I said, wait a minute, this is year number 19. Why are you showing me a different way? He said, because you're doing it wrong. Well, maybe I did do it wrong. But his issue is really you do have to floss, and so this is, you know, up in the air.
My takeaway, Zorba, You know what I'm going to do?
What?
I floss every night, and I'm going to keep flossing every night. I'm not persuaded that there's no benefit.
And I think this is a very good example of how when one bureaucratic organization says we're just going to drop it, they're not against it, we're just going to drop it, it doesn't mean we should stop doing what we're doing. I think the periodontists are right. I think flossing is a good part of oral hygiene. I think it's especially important in the older mouth as we get older because gum disease becomes more and more of an issue. And my recommendation is brush twice a day, floss once or twice a day, and your teeth will stay yours.
If you have a question for Dr. Zorba, call in now at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Back to our callers now, Zorba, in El Paso, Texas. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. I have begun drooling, and I thought maybe I was allergic to milk. I stopped drinking cow's milk, and yet I cannot seem to address the cause or eliminate the action. Do you have any thoughts on this, or?
A couple thoughts here. One of the things we do when people have excessive drooling is we look at the medications they're on. So you want to talk to your doc or your pharmacist, which is pharmacists are great resources that are underutilized, and say, is there any medication that I am taking that is causing excessive drooling? That's the first thing you want to do. The second thing you actually want to do is look at oral hygiene, because good oral hygiene, flossing, brushing your teeth, using an appropriate mouthwash that can actually make a difference in terms of your teeth, that can also reduce drooling. And then the third thing has to do with sort of the muscles in your mouth. In other words, we have saliva that we're making all the time, but some of the times we have excessive drooling because our lips are not forming properly to hold the saliva within our mouth, and it comes out. And sometimes, believe it or not, speech therapists can give you mouth and speaking lessons that can reduce the drooling that you have in your mouth, because what you have to do is learn how to swallow properly to get it out of your mouth. So your doctor can refer you to a speech therapist, because this is a common problem after people have strokes. They often have drooling after strokes. So speech therapy is the way to go. Those are the things that I would look at.
Does that sound like a plan?
Does.
Well, good luck. I hope that helps.
Yeah, speech therapists are greatly underutilized. They are wonderful for things like this. Good luck. And please, let us know what happens. Please give us a call back.
I'll do that.
Thanks for your call. If you have a question for Dr. Zorba, call in at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Okay, Zorba, let's take a dive into the murky waters of medical quackery. It's time again for Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba.
Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba.
Okay, Zorba, for today's Quacking Up segment, tell us about Dr. Anna Hatfield and her anti-kissing movement.
I have to tell you, this was a huge movement back in the 20s because they felt that kissing was immoral. It was immoral for people to kiss. And this was really post-World War I, the Roaring 20s came on, and it felt that a man and a woman who kissed, or two women who kissed and said goodbye, were basically having sex. They put it in the same realm of kissing and sex are the same. And in fact, there was a whole movement to restrict kissing to people under a certain age, you know, if they had to be an over a certain age to actually kiss. And Dr. Anna Hatfield, she was a physician. She was a member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. She had arguments. She thought kissing was, quote, a barbarous and unsanitary custom. She declared kissing to be worse than drinking. Kissing should only be conducted between betrothed couples. And she also thought that as moral bacteria, girls are taught to view a kiss with awe. And in reality, actually, mothers should be blamed for imbuing their children with the idea of kissing, that kissing is a vice, and women and children will be kissing themselves to death because they're exchanging unsanitary bacteria, which will eventually kill them.
Now, it's
It was a progressive movement. This was a long... I mean, think about it. They tried to get rid of alcohol. Mm-hmm. They tried to get rid of dancing. And they tried to get rid of kissing. Now, how successful were these moral crusaders?
People still drink and people still kiss. It sounds like a little like, oh, we're worried about the germs kissing could spread. I get that. that doesn't sound, I'm no psychologist, that doesn't sound like it was the main motivation. It sounds like aversion to anything in the neighborhood, in the ballpark, in the county of sex.
It was immoral. It was anti-vice. Now, you have to look at this. There were repercussions from the anti-kissing movement. In other words, in movies, you could only show a kiss from the side and the lips had to be closed. That was the way it was. In television programs, when I was a kid, Ozzie and Harriet slept in two beds.
Right.
You think they really slept in two beds? So there was a whole moral crusade against kissing and the exchange of fluids that stayed in the movies until the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, it sounds like this came out in the late 1800s. I'm thinking Victorian era. Wow, that sounds pretty darn Victorian. And
pretty,
I assume we're covering
Victorian.
Up our ankles.
Absolutely.
We're covering our ankles.
And
don't let anybody see those.
And you know what? In this day and age, I think it's quackery.
We'll give you a kiss if you give us a... No, we're not going to do that.
No,
but we'll talk to you and maybe even help you out if you have a question for Dr. Zorba. Call 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. We go now to Three Lakes, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
We're good. How are you doing in Three Lakes?
Excellent. Excellent.
Two weren't enough. You had to have that third lake in the mix.
Yep.
Well, what can we do to help you today?
You had a show addressing or talking about ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and pesticides and herbicides. And it wasn't clear to me which of those two, or whether it's both of them equally, might have an impact on a person getting ALS.
So the risk factors from being exposed to pesticides and herbicides, whether it might add to the risk of Lou Gehrig's disease, you're saying?
Yes. Yeah. But which one?
Hmm. Well, first of all, so do you have somebody, you know somebody with Lou Gehrig's disease?
My mother died of it at age 39.
At the age 39.
A long time ago.
What a young... Anybody else in your family, by the way?
No.
Good. So most Lou Gehrig's disease, by the way, is not genetic. There are some genetic markers for some forms of Lou Gehrig's disease. And we actually don't have any idea what causes it. We don't know. It's a neurodegenerative disease, you know, where you just lose function. Very few people live a long time, Stephen Hawking's being the rare exception. You know, just amazing that the disease sort of stopped destroying him, and he's been in this extremely stable state, or this very, very slowly deteriorating state, you know, over the years. And there's no credible evidence, really, with pesticides or insecticides that either one of them causes it. But it's a question that's come up because theoretically we know that these are neurotoxins. You know, they're neurotoxins for insects. We know that they're poisons, that if we eat them and drink them, we have neurotoxicity that's associated with it. And I think what we are talking about is whether or not that's a factor, and I think it fits into the question of whether or not that's a factor. You know, there's no evidence for or against, but it certainly is a plausible issue. Do you have any children yourself?
Yes.
How many kids?
Five, but they're all either in their 20s or 30s.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't think that there's any credible evidence. The particular call we talked about in other calls is this a good reason to go organic? You know, does that reduce the risk? I've got a neurotox, you know, as with your mom, is this going to make a difference? And I think globally the jury is out. I think if there was a big bump in ALS in the society, which there isn't, with certain insecticides, we would have seen it. But, you know, so I think I fit into perhaps, but I'm not really that concerned about it.
And are you in a place or a line of work where you worry extra about pesticide or herbicide exposure?
No, but they're two very different things,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, you can use herbicides and never have anything to do with
right.
insecticide
right.
or vice versa.
Right. Yeah.
So the original show wasn't mm-hmm. clear on whether those are equivalent and really the same.
So if I'm hearing you right,
risk factor, or is it they really were more worried about insecticides mm-hmm. than herbicides?
And if I'm hearing you right, Zorba, the answer right now is neither.
Well,
as
if
far
I were,
as we know.
If I were worried, I would be worried about insecticides because
okay.
they're neurotoxins and they're different than the herbicides. But the fact is, I'm not concerned because there's no data on it, and there has not been a tremendous increase in ALS prevalence within the society over the last 30 or 40 years. Now, I just want to make an analogy here. Asthma has increased over time in our society, and what we discovered was that asthma is related to pollution in the environment, particulate pollution, other things such as smoke, because we saw it over time, and as we got rid of smoke, made our air clearer, we've made some dent in asthma. But there are other issues with asthma which have not made a dent. So we've started to look at allergic reactions and so on. With ALS, we haven't seen a bump in society. So, and yet we know we use more herbicides and insecticides than ever before. So I think the jury is, I think the chances are pretty remote on that. And like you said, you don't have a problem and your children don't, and there's no genetic issue for most people. So good luck. How sad to lose your mom at such a young age. It must have been very, very difficult for you.
It was for everybody.
Yeah, for everybody. So thanks. Thanks so much for your call.
You bet. Thank you. Take care.
You too.
Bye. Bye-bye. If you have a question for Zorba, call in now at 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Before we sign off today, Zorba, we always love it when our listeners email us with helpful tips. You know, they give us suggestions. They're
That's
helpful
right.
people
we like
listening
suggestions.
To the show.
We like tips.
Well, the following emails from a listener named Sarah, possibly Sarah. When they don't put an H on it, I think maybe Sarah.
No.
I'm going to stick with Sarah. Sarah from Appleton, Wisconsin. Sarah offers up this helpful piece of culinary advice. Dr. Zorba, I have a much better method to remove seeds from cucumbers rather than using your fingers. If I get a big cucumber, you know, they're seedy. You want to get those seeds out. My method, she says, is much more efficient and leaves your fingers clean. I use, she says, a grapefruit spoon. I will cut the cucumber in half lengthwise and then simply run the grapefruit spoon. Hard to say grapefruit spoon, but she runs it down the center of the cucumber. Thanks. I enjoy your show. Great advice, except I hate grapefruit. I don't have a grapefruit spoon. Do you have a grapefruit spoon?
I have a grapefruit. My wife loves grapefruit. We always have a grapefruit spoon. You know, it's got that little serrated at the bottom of the spoon. It's serrated.
Okay.
That's what it is.
It's kind of like when I used to do canning, I had the best named kitchen utensil ever, the tomato shark. It's kind of like it was a melon baller, but it had teeth. So you would, when you needed to take the stem out of the tomato,
what's called
that tomato shark.
Well,
yeah, because it's got shark-like teeth.
Too. I love it. Cooking tips.
That would work great for
send them along.
Cucumber seeds. If you have a helpful tip for Zorba, just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web.
At ZorbaPastor.org.
Or you can find us on Facebook. And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Rob Ferret, sitting in for Tom Clark, asking you to join us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0917Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.